Need financial security? Get some insurance.
AIG American General Insurers. We're the number one term insurance company in the U.S. with the financial strength to be there when you need us so you can sleep better at night.
Oh, well. AIG executives got no sleep last night worrying if they would exist today. They do, courtesy of an $85 billion bailout from the feds. When the insurance company needs life insurance, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
That's a good one, when the insurance company needs life insurance. Like that, John. Good morning. It's Wednesday, September 17th. Good morning.
Good morning, Adora.
Today, the big news on Wall Street is the Federal Reserve's about-face. Its decision to rescue the global insurance giant, AIG, after officials said they would not do so. We'll take a look. Also, the aftermath of Hurricane Ike has triggered massive power outages, many evacuees, and today, concerns about major flooding in the Midwest. And on Capitol Hill, after intense debate late last night, the House passed an energy bill. Those stories are coming up, but first, these headlines.
Surprise and relief on Wall Street today. Last night, the Fed came to the rescue of embattled insurance giant AIG to the tune of $85 billion in loans. In return, the central bank gets nearly an 80% stake in the company. The Fed didn't slash interest rates yesterday, as many investors hoped, but the AIG bailout is stabilizing markets around the world. If you've always dreamed of setting up your own offshore drilling rig in the U.S. waters, now is your chance. The House passed a comprehensive energy bill last night, ending a nearly three-decade ban on the practice, but there's a catch. The rigs have to be at least 50 miles out. That's just one of the reasons the measure upset Republicans. Indiana Republican Congressman Mike Pence says the bill puts too many limitations on drilling.
The Drill Nothing Congress has brought a bill that actually includes basically drill almost nothing provisions. They say yes to drilling, but not in Alaska, not in the Eastern Gulf, and not within 50 miles.
And not until the Senate okays the bill, which is
another whole long road. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates is in Afghanistan today. He already met with President Hamid Karzai. There's increasing anger in the country over civilian deaths caused by U.S. airstrikes. Gates expressed regret over the loss of innocent lives and said the U.S. will try to do better.
You have my word that we will do everything in our power to find new and better ways to target our common enemies while protecting the good people of Afghanistan.
Gates said no other military has done more to prevent civilian casualties. A group calling itself Islamic Jihad in Yemen is claiming responsibility for a car bombing outside the U.S. embassy in the capital today. The attack killed at least 16 people. The group is threatening more attacks if some of its members are not released from jail.
Complaints coming in from Texas in the aftermath of Hurricane Ike. Officials in Texas are complaining that FEMA's not doing its job. Here we go again. In politics, John McCain is campaigning in Michigan. Barack Obama is still in Nevada. He's got an event in Las Vegas tonight. Oil prices rebounded in Asian trading, $94 a barrel. And the Dow is up more than 1%. Yesterday, it begins trading at 11,059. We're talking about bailouts. How much should the government be willing to bail out financial organizations in need? Is $85 billion too much?
Especially when it's taxpayer dollars. Should we, the public, pay for the mistakes of business? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. As we've been hearing this morning in the news, the biggest insurance company in the world, turns out, has one of the biggest life insurance policies in the world. And that would make the governor of New York, David Paterson, someone who helped write that insurance policy.
Through a reorganization and further action, jobs will be saved, businesses will be made stable, and certainly our financial recovery will be easier, if not sooner.
Well, $85 billion is what the AIG company gets in loans from the federal government, and David Paterson, the governor of New York, helped to engineer the bailout of AIG, which it is said the collapse of which would send ripples through the financial markets, already reeling from turmoil from the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers and the acquisition of Merrill Lynch by Bank of America. Joining us now is Michael Hunter, who's a markets reporter for the Financial Times. Does this end a chapter? Is it time to take a breath here, or is there more to come, Michael?
Well, John, no one in London's been able to take much of a breath this morning at all, although we started trading with a huge, widespread breath of relief that AIG had been rescued due to the way it's interconnected right the way throughout the world financial system. The crisis has rolled on in other directions. We've seen an unprecedented spell of volatility in our own banks in London. Two of the biggest banks listed on the FTSE 100 are in emergency merger talks. And the sense of crisis still, I think, is foremost in everyone's mind at the moment.
Is what is driving the market turmoil this morning in London a sense that banks are going to be consolidating there, that we're going to be seeing some acquisitions in London?
Yeah, that's exactly right. HBOS, the UK's biggest mortgage lender, is in merger talks with Lloyds TSB, London, another big London bank known for its conservative approach to lending and its conservative way of running its own balance sheet. But really what we're seeing, I think, not just in London, but over in New York and around the world as well, John, are the way in which traders are struggling to work out exactly what the repercussions of all these different problems with the interconnected world financial system are going to be. People still have yet to get a real proper handle on what the unwinding of Lehman will really mean. Now we know that AIG isn't going to go the same way as Lehman. That's helped to an extent. But the process of finding out exactly how much money is owed to whom, by whom, and under what terms is still going on.
Well, you describe what's going on with such a sense of mystery. I wonder if I could take a contrary view. This is just a simple matter of there's too many banks, and there are going to be fewer of them, and that's the way it is. The amount of money in the economies, they're all secure. It's just there's too many banks, Michael.
I think that's absolutely right, John. And I think we've got a big oversupply of financial services. But when we had interest rates so low for so long, and this tendency for financial innovation to allow a lot of people to make a lot of money very quickly selling mortgage-backed securities and other complex debt products to each other, some very, very clever people lost sight of the fundamentals, which is when interest rates eventually rise after being so low for so long, a lot of people might have problems paying back mortgages. And it really does come back to that kind of simple idea. But the way in which the financial system allowed itself to grow out of control and get so overcomplicated is going to take a very, very long time to knock through and become clear in itself.
And well, Michael, I think that some people would argue that they're actually not that clever. But what has been the response, if any, of Barclays stepping into the Lehman bankruptcy and buying a portion of that business?
Barclays is one of the few London banks where we've seen steady, unturbulent, consistent rises in its share price today. It looks to most London investors, I think it's fair to say, that Barclays has got a real bargain in buying the parts of Lehman which it's moved in to get hold of for $1.57 billion, the broker-dealer operation, the Manhattan headquarters and two data centres. I think that's gone down very well over here. I think Barclays has moved just at the right time and got a good price for what's fundamentally a promising business in many ways.
In fact, it was a no-brainer. I mean, Barclays just said, no, I don't want to buy it today. I'll just wait till they go bankrupt and get it for like a tenth of the value. It was a fabulous proposition.
Very much so. But at the same time, there's still an element of risk involved in some ways putting more of your own business at risk to running that operation and making sure that you can run it properly in these very turbulent and dangerous times as well.
Well, it's a strange business proposition, trying to create value by swallowing things which have marginal or questionable value. Michael Hunter, thanks for sorting it out for us. He's markets reporter for the Financial Times. He spoke with us from London. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, John.
And we need some analysis on this.
I was going to say, we're going to bring in Peter Morici to this conversation. He's a professor of international business at the University of Maryland and probably a familiar voice to many of you at this point. Happy to say, Peter, you're joining us this morning. How do you sum up where the market is going to start the day off when trading opens in an hour and 15 minutes or so?
Well, I would would guess it would open up because essentially what the Fed and the Treasury have done is guaranteed the liquidity and the solvency of the New York banks despite all the bad paper on their books. By guaranteeing AIG, it's guaranteeing the insurance policies that AIG wrote on their bad bonds. So let's be clear, the Fed isn't bailing out AIG. The Fed is bailing out Citigroup and the rest of the cohort without getting much in return. While it has, it has a claim on AIG, Citigroup gets to rely on the Fed through AIG to guarantee the bogus securities on its books and continue to pay its executives royally for having messed up the financial system.
And Peter, we're talking about taxpayer money here. So what am I getting in return for this investment that the Federal Reserve has decided I need to make?
Well, it's really not so much taxpayer money. They're printing money. All right. But the bottom line is that the stock prices are way down because of this financial engineering. Stockholders at AIG will lose a great deal of money. But the executives at AIG will get to leave with their multi-million dollar packages. Likewise, over at Citigroup, they've absolutely run the bank into the ground. Now, who are the stockholders? Well, if you have an IRA or a KEO or a retirement system that's asset-based as opposed to benefits-based, you're generally invested in some sort of index fund of the S&P or the broader stock market, because it's impossible to run a large mutual fund otherwise. And as a consequence, we're all seeing our retirement portfolios shrink, so we're all paying a tax that way. And that tax is going to see to it that Vikram Pandit continues to get hundreds of millions of dollars by being CEO of Citigroup. He's literally stealing the bread from the mouths of widows.
Although, Peter, what do you say to the argument that some make in the investment community that the salaries of executives at these banks, while high and sort of comparatively, you know, obscene compared to the median income in the United States, are still financially a drop in the bucket in terms of what these big banks are worth? And to change that isn't necessarily going to change the risk proposition.
Absolutely, I don't agree with that. First of all, they're paid much more than industrial executives, say executives at General Motors or General Electric and so forth. And the incentive systems that we put in place encourage them to take these reckless bets. What's happened is that they are not going to be penalized for what they've done, and I guarantee it. You can reassemble these banks, you can consolidate them, you can put them into all kinds of new creations. These financial engineers will continue to do very bad things given the chance, and they will.
Peter,
at Citigroup, they're abandoning the commercial banking business, even though we've shored them up, and they're basically going speculating in other places. Until you remove these people and take away this compensation scheme, which rewards them for making big bets but doesn't penalize them when they fail, you're going to continue to have trouble.
In terms of accountability, when you take a look at Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, any of these companies, and some of the statements that have been made by the executives in the days and weeks leading up to their various collapses. Is there potentially any criminal investigations in some of the statements that have been made?
Not really. My feeling is that corporations can reward, under the law, corporations can reward their executives as they please, and shareholders cannot bring suit to nullify them if they make bad decisions.
No, but that's different. No, I guess my question is, if they're making statements about their company is fine, that their balance sheet is fine, that they have enough assets to cover whatever bets they've made, and it turns out that none of those things are true, aren't there rules against that?
Well, the question is, did they commit fraud? And that's very difficult to prove in this kind of context. You really need a criminal lawyer that's familiar with financial dealings. But look how few people went to jail in the accounting frauds that were discovered in the wake of the Enron era. It was much more widespread than Enron, but still no one really went to jail, or hardly anyone went to jail. So I would suggest to you that we're not likely to get much satisfaction that way. But there are things that can be done. The Federal Reserve is propping up Citigroup. Essentially, the Federal Reserve is loaning on a revolving basis every 30 or 60 days money to Citigroup.
Mm-hmm.
It simply can roll in there and tell Vikram that congratulations, you now earn $1 million a year. The president of the New York Fed earns less. If you don't like it, we're pulling the loans.
Okay.
What happened last night was there was a game
Peter,
of chicken. And the
Peter,
Fed
Peter,
yeah.
We love having you on the show, but we got to leave it there. Peter Morici,
okay.
Professor of International Business at University of Maryland. Thank you.
Yeah.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. On this Wednesday, September 17th, there's lots of talk about bailouts, not only here in the United States, but also in Europe and markets throughout the world. And we're asking, how much should the government be willing to bail out financial companies in need? Should you foot the bill? Should taxpayers be footing the bill in the public's good, at least if that's what the government is saying? Bob sends us an email. Welcome to America, Inc., land of the risk-free corporate save. And Leon, the poet from Brooklyn, has this verse. Bailouts, our government is there for fat cats and the fatter. Those deemed too big to fail while we're too small to matter. What do you think about this? Give us your thoughts. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Insurance poetry. They call them river systems in the United States for a good reason. When a big storm hits a river, it can cause problems way upstream. At KWMU Public Radio in St. Louis, Adam Allington has been covering the aftermath of Hurricane Ike from St. Louis all week. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning.
So, you know, it feels to me as though there's a wave that started in, Texas and moved its way straight up to the river system around St. Louis. What are you dealing with right now?
Right now we're dealing with, it's kind of the typical scenario of a slow rise on the Mississippi River affecting downtown St. Louis, and then also rises on the rivers immediately surrounding the city, the Merrimack River, the Missouri River, the Illinois River.
And the impact of Ike for you was principally rain, or was it rain, wind, and surge? What are you dealing with specifically from the storm?
Well, it was principally rain. I mean, the region just got soaked on Sunday, just a lot of rain all at once, and that caused a lot of flash flooding. Actually, we had three fatalities here in St. Louis, but long-term, I mean, that weather went all the way up to Chicago. There was significant flooding in Chicago, and all that rain is making its way now down the Illinois River and then also into the tributaries around St. Louis, and that's where we're seeing the rivers rising quite quickly on along the periphery, and there's just a lot of sandbagging efforts and homes and property that's going to be underwater.
And when you're in a river city like St. Louis, there's really nowhere for the water to go. You're in the bottom of the basin, and the river
that's
is where
right.
the water goes. It's a chain reaction.
Right. We're in a floodplain, and that's kind of that's become the nature of flooding in the Midwest, especially along the Mississippi, is that there's been so many levees that have been built that have restricted the width of the Mississippi River, not just the Mississippi, but all the major rivers, and that's just sort of pushed the water farther down for someone else to deal with. In St. Louis City, we're actually pretty lucky. We have a very big levee system, a flood wall downtown, so it would have to be really drastic for St. Louis City to see the kind of flooding that, say, Cedar Rapids, Iowa saw in June. But for the outlying areas south of St. Louis, north of St. Louis, where they have just small agricultural levees, they've seen really drastic flooding, not just now, but also, like I say, earlier on in June and before that in March, really several major flood events in the last 6 months.
And speaking of those June floods, which were unprecedented. We've
right.
seen reports that utility agencies are saying that right now the potential for the flooding and some of the flooding in the St. Louis metro region is actually worse than it was in June.
That's right. That's right. We just got so much rain locally right in St. Louis. It was kind of like pouring a bathtub into a teacup, and the water just it was kind of the opposite of what we're used to. Like I say, where we see flooding at the periphery on the rivers, this really started right in the middle of the region. Now it's flowing out. Mm. And a lot of people without power, a lot of people with water in their basements right now, which is a health hazard.
Adam, when you talk to your friends and neighbors and people in the community about their view of these events, are people feeling less secure about the infrastructure? St. Louis is right next to the river, and generally people in St. Louis don't give it much thought, but I'm wondering if that's changing.
I think it is changing. I mean, in St. Louis City, in the major downtown area, again, people feel pretty secure. But in the sort of metro region, there's a big discussion now about floodplain development and the building of these levees and if it's really worth it, essentially. I mean, we had this major, major flood in 1993, the Great Flood of 93, which is the record by which all this discussion is based on now. But since then, there's been about 28,000 homes on 6,000 acres, all built in land that was underwater then.
Wow.
And people are now just wondering, when these places continually get flooded and they continually have to rebuild, is it worth it now? Because we've seen that, again, in the last 6 months, we've seen these areas flooded several times.
Adam, given what's happening today, what kind of efforts are being made to prepare for what could be more extensive flooding in the region?
Well, we really dodged a bullet this time because we've had a pretty clear forecast all week, some dry weather, so we're able to just sort of let that water flow into the rivers and deal with it by sandbagging. But if we'd gotten more rain this week, we would have been dealing with another crisis situation. Mm-hmm. Again, so right now it's kind of a slow, well, not a slow rise, but it should crest on the Mississippi and Merrimack rivers sometime late tonight or early tomorrow morning. And then the water should recede quickly from that point. But right now people are sandbagging. Again, there's really not much people can do. Some communities are implementing flood buyout programs to buy homes and properties that are in this floodplain.
But in general, it's watching the river flow. That's sort of the strategy at this point, watching the river flow and thinking about the tough consequences of riverfront development. Adam Allington, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Adam reports for KWMU, the public radio station in St. Louis. And now headlines from Femi Oke.
Thanks, John. Just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. AIG is getting an $85 billion bailout from the US government. The Fed announced the move yesterday. And overnight, the British bank Barclays said that it's scooping up the North American holdings of Lehman Brothers. The UK firm is paying $1.75 billion for what's left of Lehman Brothers after a spectacular decline in value this year. Bomb blasts outside the gates of the US embassy in Yemen have killed 16 people. Six of the dead were attackers, and among them a suicide bomber wearing a suicide vest. Four civilians were also killed. An Islamic extremist group is claiming responsibility for the attack and it's threatening more. Admiral Mike Mullen, head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is in Pakistan today. He's met with military officials in an effort to ease tensions over recent US raids on Pakistani territory. Pakistan is furious over the raid and says that from now on, it will open fire if US forces cross its borders. And Mullen vows the US will respect the country's sovereignty. And a chemical used in plastic bottles could be linked to higher rates of heart disease, diabetes and liver problems. That's according to a new study released ahead of federal hearings on the subject. Bisphenol A or BPA is so ubiquitous it's in the system of almost every American. And some lawmakers want to ban the chemical, but the FDA says it is actually safe.
Lots of debate there. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, probing topical issues such as mothers who meet at a bar for drinks and bring their babies. Is it fair to the other patrons? Is it fair for bars to prohibit them? Conversations found at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adore Udoji.
You have my word that we will do everything in our power to find new and better ways to target our common enemies while protecting the good people of Afghanistan.
That's U.S. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, currently in Afghanistan, expressing personal regret over civilian casualties at the hands of international forces. We go live now to Kabul, where BBC correspondent Martin Patience is on the line. And Martin, we're going to get to the secretary's visit, but also today the U.S. is reporting that four soldiers and an Afghan national have been killed in a bomb blast. What can you tell us about that?
Well, there isn't a great amount of details. American military say that they're informing the family of those four dead soldiers. We believe that this happened in the east of the country, near the Pakistani tribal, the border areas with Pakistan, which has seen an upsurge in violence in recent months. In fact, in the last few months, the number of attacks has increased 50%. Compared to last year. And obviously that was the area where a couple of months ago Taliban insurgents and Al-Qaeda insurgents overran a U.S. military outpost, killing 9 American soldiers.
So in this midst of increased violence, the Secretary of Defense is meeting with top officials there in Afghanistan. Why do you think it was so important for him to express personal regret over civilian casualties that the U.N. says this week has risen to 1,400 this year?
Well, the issue of civilian casualties is hugely sensitive here. Only last month, American airstrikes, according to the Afghan government and the UN, killed 91 civilians in the west of the country, in the Shindan district of Herat province. There's a real degree of anger here, not only from ordinary Afghans, but from Afghan politicians. Yesterday, the upper house of the Afghan parliament walked out in protest over civilian deaths at the hands of foreign forces. It's hugely sensitive, and when you're fighting a campaign to win the hearts and minds of the Afghan population, when you kill civilians, that turns a village, if not a district, against you, and it makes that fight all the much harder. And many of these people, these disillusioned civilians, people that have lost loved ones, they turn against international forces and in some cases support the Taliban.
Martin, what do you know about the secretary's agenda there in Afghanistan?
Well, as you'd imagine, it's shrouded in a blanket of security. There's real security concerns here. We understand that he will be meeting the Afghan president, Hamid Karzai. He'll also be expected to meet American commanders to discuss new strategies. Obviously, last week, the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chief of Staff, Michael Mullen, announced a new strategy. He said that America needed to win this war, and what that would involve would be eliminating what he called insurgent sanctuaries on the Pakistani side of the border.
Yeah, it certainly, Martin, involves crossing that Pakistani border, and I'm wondering if there's a fine line that Secretary Gates has to toe here. What is he saying about these cross-border raids inside Afghanistan? There are already military officials meeting with the Pakistani officials about what seems to be escalating tensions on the Pakistani side of the border. What's Gates have to say about that?
Well, on this visit, he's been very guarded on this subject. All he's been saying is that we need to work more with Pakistan to deal with this issue. Again, this is hugely sensitive. In the past, there have been American airstrikes in Pakistan. Obviously, Pakistani officials have protested hugely to the American administration. They see this as an infringement on the sovereignty of their country, and they say that it won't be justified. The big problem is, how can you fight a military campaign here in Afghanistan when the people you're fighting are taking sanctuary in Pakistan, plotting and then launching attacks against international forces and the Afghan government and police inside Afghanistan? Most people would say that's unpalatable, and that Pakistan needs to do more in these tribal areas. And if Pakistan doesn't do it, then the American and international forces say that they will have to do it themselves.
And clearly, Martin, it sounds from what we do know that the secretary is trying to lay the groundwork for what will likely to be an increased presence and increased attention to what's happening in Afghanistan. Let's listen to a bit of what he said.
Ultimately, you are a self-reliant people who want to secure your own nation. So I strongly support Minister Wardock's plan to expand the size of the Afghan National Army to 134,000. And I will do whatever is necessary to ensure the proper training and funding of those forces.
Martin, what do you know about how those forces are doing?
Well, certainly the Afghan National Army and the Afghan police often fight in coordination with the international forces in Afghanistan. Now, the Afghan position here is they want to put an Afghan face. They want to have an Afghan lead on the fighting against the Taliban. As we said earlier, international forces are becoming increasingly unpopular in this country. And what the President Hamid Karzai, the Afghan President Hamid Karzai, wants is they want an increased capacity of the Afghan National Army. So it will help Afghanistan stand on its own 2 feet and be less reliant on international forces who are becoming increasingly unpopular here.
Martin Patience, thank you very much. Martin Patience is a BBC correspondent, and he was reporting from Kabul. Now we're going to turn to Femi Okeh, who's got some headlines for us. Femi?
Thank you very much. It is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. U.S. taxpayers are now the owners of 80% of AIG after the Federal Reserve ponied up $85 billion for a bailout. The Fed decided not to act earlier this week as Lehman Brothers went down, but it said things were different with AIG. They said the bailout was necessary because the failure of AIG, let me quote here, could add to already significant levels of financial market fragility, end of quote. The Fed's move to bail out AIG doesn't appear to be doing the trick for investors. U.S. stocks are headed for a lower open. Both John McCain and Barack Obama have scrambled this week to release new campaign ads saying that they're going to be the better leader for tough economic times. Barack Obama's two-minute ad restates his promise of middle-class tax cuts, tougher regulations on the financial industry, and the end of America's dependence on Middle East oil. And meanwhile, John McCain's ad promises to keep U.S. jobs and people's savings safe while he reforms Wall Street. The House has given a green light to offshore drilling, so long as it takes place 50 or more miles out to sea. Republicans say that's too far. They say the estimated 18 billion gallons of oil could be much closer to the shore. Either way, President Bush vowed a veto. And Alaska's investigation into whether Sarah Palin abused her power as governor by firing the state's public safety commissioner has run into intensified resistance from Republican lawmakers. Alaska's House Speaker is openly questioning its impartiality and raising the possibility of delaying the findings, perhaps until November the 5th.
Yeah, John McCain has certainly stirred things up in Alaska. That's for sure. Who would ever be reporting on an investigation in Alaska? Thank you, Femi.
It's an important place.
The Palin effect.
We like that state.
The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry.
You make time and you make love dandy. You make swell molasses candy. But honey, are you making any money? That's all I want to know.
They make headlines with eye-popping numbers, but bailouts, loan packages, and financial flameouts are a part of American history going way back. The American colonies were bailed out by the French during the Revolutionary War, and then we bailed out the debt-plagued French by buying Louisiana so they could pay for all of Napoleon's wars. The big federal and corporate bailouts, they came later. The entire federal treasury was bailed out twice by the same guy, J.P. Morgan. First in 1893, when J.P. himself wrote a check to bail out Washington. Then in the panic of 1907, he and his banker friends helped save the federal treasury again. The Federal Reserve was actually established in part because Washington figured out J.P. Morgan wouldn't be around forever. The bank is still a bank, though. The modern age of corporate bailouts began in 1970 when the huge railroad Penn Central ceased to exist. The federal government broke up the company and its assets eventually became Amtrak and the CSX freight system. Cost to the Treasury, $575 million.
Sorry, I'm out of business. I'm not at your service anymore.
A year later, the defense contractor Lockheed, pleading jobs and national security, got $220 million from Congress to save it from going under. In 1975, it was New York City itself, wallowing in debt. New York nearly defaulted. The federal government said no to New York, famously. The city was saved by a $150 million loan from the city's teachers union pension fund. We broke through the billion-dollar threshold in 1979 when Chrysler was bailed out by the Carter administration to the tune of $1.5 billion. The bailout made executive Lee Iacocca's career and produced a famous line of cheap cars here immortalized by the Bare Naked Ladies.
Well, I'd buy you a K-car, a nice, reliant automobile.
K-car. Remember those K-cars. Now we're starting to hit the mother load, though, the savings and loan crisis. Here's Ohio Senator Howard Metzenbaum.
What we have here is a national crisis for the American people, resulting in a financial windfall for a few wealthy investors.
The S&L crisis broke all records. In the late 1980s, the first Bush administration authorized $166 billion over 10 years to dissolve and bail out S&Ls across the country. It became a political issue.
They locked you out based upon age and race and class. Now let those who had the party pay for the party.
Party politics. Paying for the savings and loan crisis party was one reason why the Republican Party lost the White House in 1992. Fast forward to 2001. The airline industry takes a direct hit after the 9/11 terrorist attacks.
A collapse of the airline industry all across this country would be devastating. And you talk about lost jobs. Talking to some of the executives in my own district about what's happening to the car rental agencies, what's happening to the hotels, what's happening to the theme parks, what's happening to the restaurants, and all of the people who work in those businesses.
Congress authorized $15 billion in cash and loans to save the airlines. Jury's still out on whether it worked, and it's kind of what we're observing now. Intended to stop more bailouts, we have bailouts. In just a few months, Bear Stearns, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and now AIG. Stay tuned. They're making history with other people's money. There's a job I'd like to have.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. It's Wednesday and it's September 17th, and we have the latest headline for you, at least what's happening this morning. Femi Okeh is here with it all.
Thanks very much, Adore. It is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Just got some figures in for the current account trade deficit. It rises 4.3% to just over $183 billion as the oil bill increases. In other news, the federal government has agreed to provide an $85 billion emergency loan to rescue American International Group. The Federal Reserve says it's determined that a disorderly failure of the huge insurer could hurt the already delicate financial markets and the economy. Defense Secretary Robert Gates is in Afghanistan to meet with officials and offer that his personal regret for U.S. airstrikes that have mistakenly killed civilians. He blamed the use of airstrikes on a lack of U.S. ground troops in the country, and he pledged more accurate targeting in the future. An August raid is believed to have killed as many as 90 Afghan civilians, including women and children. Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff will be back in Texas today to take a look at post-Ike recovery efforts in Houston and Galveston. Houston's mayor, Bill White, has said that he's unhappy with FEMA. He says they're not delivering supplies fast enough.
Maybe he should order them from someone besides FEMA. Maybe. Sorry. Anyway, that's go.
Ask your editorializing.
Maybe FEMA should do their job.
Oh my goodness! And maybe I can just get on with the news. And near Galveston, about 250 residents of the hard-hit Bolivar Peninsula are refusing to leave. Officials say it's a health issue with a lack of utilities raising concerns about the spread of disease. The Texas Attorney General's office is exploring how to legally force them out. And a couple of animal problems in Texas as well, because the flooding caused animals to be displaced. There was a lion that actually had to take sanctuary in a sanctuary at a church, and a tiger that's on the loose as well. Let's have a listen in to Galveston County Judge James Yarbrough, who broke the news about the missing tiger.
The tiger's loose. I understand he's hungry, so we're staying away from him. I don't want to say there's such thing as a tame tiger, but the tiger's been there a long time, well known to the community.
Maybe the tiger was let loose to encourage the 250 residents of Bolivar Peninsula to leave the peninsula.
That'll work. Good call.
That's your news.
Thank you, Femi.
Thanks for joining in.
Also in the news today is what happened on Capitol Hill last night. There was an intense debate about an energy bill, and late last night, well, the House passed one.
It showed up here last night at 9:45. A 290-page bill, 9:45 last night, that no member had ever seen. And guess what? As we stand here tonight, no member has read. All right, anybody, member? Show me. Some member stand up and tell me you've read this bill. That's what I suspected. Not one member.
Not a whole lot of joy, at least not in that legislature. The bill has renewable fuels, cracks down on big oil subsidies, and it expands on offshore oil drilling. It contains many things, but it's not likely to pass the Senate as it is. Some are calling this bill an election year energy bill. For more on this...
Yes.
Wow, that's an interesting intro. Thanks for that, Dylan, our engineer. That's right, we have our own Todd Zwillick from Capital News Connection with us. Good morning, Todd.
Van Halen?
Todd, you've got a theme song, dude.
Do you feel welcomed this morning?
I do. As long as it's Van Halen, I'm down with it.
Well, what happened last night?
Well, everything that you said was absolutely correct. They passed this bill, and everyone's been waiting on it for a long time. But what really happened was a standoff on this election issue. The bill did pass, and it does expand offshore drilling, which is this thing that Democrats sworn they wouldn't do for, I don't know, the last 15 or 20 years. This has been anathema to them. So here they come sort of to the middle and say, here's some offshore drilling that Republicans have been demanding all through August and July and June. And the bill passed not quite on a party line vote, but pretty close to it. This is a great big election issue, and that's why nobody really expects any of this policy that was passed by the House to actually make it into the books of any law by year's end.
So why did the Democrats do an about-face? Does it have anything to do with the fact that opinion polls show that a growing number of Americans are actually for offshore drilling?
Oh sure. I mean, it has to have to do with that exactly. Republicans spent all of August while the Congress was on August recess. Republicans had this sort of revolving daily kind of what they called protests coming on a darkened House floor and giving speeches to tourists, essentially, and any reporters that were straggling around on the importance of offshore drilling and why Democrats weren't for it. This is the one big, solid issue that Republicans have gotten some traction on.
Except they're not happy about this. They're not happy about this bill because it's got this 50-mile offshore restriction, which puts Alaska and lots of the Gulf off the table. I mean, is this a kind of a compromise in name only?
Yeah, well, Republicans call it a smokescreen or smoke and mirrors or whatever metaphor, John, and that's exactly right. There's a buffer of 50 miles, and then outside of 100 miles, you could drill without a state's approval. Republicans say this is just a smokescreen political cover so that Democrats have something to vote for, so they can say, yes, I did vote for offshore drilling, just like you wanted, public. Democrats, on the other hand, say we have never been for any opening up any more offshore drilling than we already have. We've come a long way towards the Republicans on this. There is no bill we could have produced that Republicans would have supported anyway. And why is that? Because, like we just said, Republicans have traction on an issue finally, especially an issue on domestic policy. Why in the world would they all of a sudden vote for a bill and come together with Democrats and give up the only issue that they've got they've got any tread on here?
And that's an important point, because regardless, it's not likely to pass the Senate. I mean, the Senate has a whole different bill that they're taking a look at.
That's right. The Senate may get to this by the end of this week, more likely next week, and they're going to probably start from a whole different paradigm. Parts of the bill might be similar, but the procedure, and we don't have to get into it, but the way the Senate is going to address this is going to be far different. And even if this bill doesn't get filibustered in the Senate, which it could well do, despite this a group of people who are trying to compromise, normal legislating and normal passing of laws would then require a House of goodwill and a Senate of goodwill and members of both parties of goodwill to come together and produce something.
That would require another country, actually.
That, by the way, that a president of goodwill would be willing to sign. Hmm. And nothing is impossible, but if you think that that's going to happen 5 weeks before a contentious election, I'll put my money on that one.
Yeah. Let's talk about the dynamic that exists now in Washington, given the fact that the elections are just weeks away at this point.
Right. Well, Congress is designed at this point to be pretty much all politics all the time. On the big issues that require action immediately, for instance, the AIG bailout of last night, members of Congress were briefed on that by Bernanke and Paulson, but they weren't asked their opinion. They were told. So at times like this, Congress is sort of, well, in that issue, Congress is sidelined, probably by necessity. And on most things at this point, when you have 535 members, most of whom are running for reelection, and they all want the guy of their party to get elected president, it's almost impossible to expect them to pass any kind of compromise legislation of any import. They might get one or two small things. Some post offices get named, probably without a problem. Maybe a couple of scenic trails in the Grand Canyon or something.
That's good. Let's take care of that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Todd. Okay, yeah. Todd. Thanks very much. Todd Zwillick reporting from Washington, D.C., from the Capital News Connection.
And, dude, check your Van Halen. It's Blue Oyster Cult.
Oh, God, I'm sorry. Is it real? Sorry.
Maybe we'll let him back.
Well, that was me repeating myself. Thanks, Todd Zwillick.
Well, there's lots of ways to catch up with us on The Takeaway. You can find us on Twitter, Friend Feed, and Facebook.
And we are talking about bailouts. How much should the government be willing to bail out financial companies in need?
Hi, it's Dave from Providence. At least we're spending some of our money at home. Not all of it's leaving. You know, it's money we could be spending on war efforts. Is that what they're called?
What's your take? Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
A lot of bitterness out there. Adora, this issue has one person thinking not of the economy, but of the election.
Hi, this is Chris from Brooklyn. The more I'm listening, the more I'm thinking this is a big scam. And again, it ties into the election. Which ticket is talking about less government, less regulation? Obviously, we need a little more regulation in the banking industry, for one. And which ticket is not saying that stuff? Everybody has to really, really think hard.
Yeah, like Todd Zwillick says, they're not doing in Washington right now. We're following the election just weeks to go. If you're not sure what you think about the candidates, we've got a tool for you on Facebook. It's called Who Should I Vote For? You enter three qualities you'd like in your next president, and other Facebook users will tell you who you should vote for. You can also tell us what you think of the candidates. There's a link on our homepage, thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and you're listening to The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Food that's medicine. Ugh, who would eat that?
Let's get Mikey.
Yeah. He won't eat it. He hates everything. He likes it. Hey, Mikey.
Even Mikey would like some of the new high-tech foods that actually contain vitamins and medicine. fish oil in your orange juice. Mmm, try it. You'll like it. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, and I'm telling you, John, I don't think you sold that exactly how, I don't know, some of the orange juice companies would like you to do so. Good morning. It's Wednesday, September 17th.
Good morning, Adora.
And today we're going to take a look at the Federal Reserve's decision to step in and save the troubled insurance giant, AIG, after officials said they would not. Also, Hurricane Ike's aftermath is far from over. Millions are without power. Thousands have been forced from their homes. And today in the Midwest, they are bracing for major flooding. The presidential candidates are swapping attacks on who can better fix the economy and food. How about some sardines with that orange juice?
I told you.
We're going to take a look at that. It's a true story. Those stories are coming up. But first, these headlines.
Sweeping the country. Fish in your orange juice. But first, lots of dramatic rescues in the financial world. AIG is getting an $85 billion leg up from the federal government. The central bank gets a majority stake in the insurance company in return for the massive loans that will keep the fragile company in business. A bailout, kind of, for Lehman Brothers now that it's bankrupt. British bank Barclays is buying the company's U.S. operations. It comes, of course, too late to keep Lehman out of bankruptcy. It's filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates is in Afghanistan today. He's already met with President Hamid Karzai. Afghans are saying enough is enough when it comes to U.S. airstrikes. The bombs have killed scores of civilians along with militants. Gates expressed regret over the loss of innocent lives and said the U.S. will try to do better.
You have my word that we will do everything in our power to find new and better ways to target our common enemies while protecting the good people of Afghanistan.
Just across the border in Pakistan, Admiral Mike Mullen, the head of the U.S. military, is meeting with Pakistani army leaders. Now, he's trying to calm Pakistani anger over recent U.S. attacks on Pakistan's soil. U.S. forces have staged raids in recent weeks, and now Pakistan, at least the army, has told its soldiers to fire at U.S. troops should they come across from Afghanistan into Pakistan.
U.S. companies can start offshore drilling for the first time in almost 30 years, but only if they do it 50 miles away from the U.S. coastline. That's in a House bill that passed last night, still has to go to the Senate, and the president has vowed to veto it. Israel's governing coalition is choosing a new prime minister today. In Yemen, a coordinated suicide attack by Islamic extremists on the U.S. embassy has killed 16 people. The markets open in just a half hour. Pre-market numbers are down slightly. Oil is up $94 a barrel. We're talking about bailouts like everyone else.
Yes. Should taxpayer money be used to help private companies when they're about to go under? And especially if it's supposedly in the interest of the public good, should the money be used?
Well, whether you like it or not, it is being used, and we've unleashed a whole chorus of bitterness and anger on this subject at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
A lot of questions.
At thetakeaway.org. Lots of you are responding. Keep it up.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
The board of AIG has accepted an offer from the Federal Reserve Board whereby the feds will allow AIG to receive a revolving loan of $85 billion to be paid back over a 24-month period.
That's New York Governor David Paterson explaining the new lease on life for the global insurance company AIG. Last night, Federal Reserve officials stepped in after saying they would not, giving the company an $85 billion injection of taxpayer money, consider it an emergency loan. In exchange, the Fed takes an 80% stake in the company and the right to get rid of senior management. Joining us for more is Dan Gross, senior editor and columnist at Newsweek magazine. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, and so, congratulations. You now own AIG.
Wow, I'm so happy.
I don't know what to say.
Whoa.
So, Dan, what do you make of this reversal, and what does it mean for AIG and the economy?
Well, this is a, you know, what the Brits might refer to as a monstrous cock-up. AIG got itself into so much trouble. This is an insurance company that was kind of running like a hedge fund, guaranteeing and insuring all these financial products, and it became apparent that it needed just vast quantities of capital in order just to survive. Given the markets, no one was in the mood to provide it, and the government, the Federal Reserve, the Treasury, was concerned about the implications for the global financial system if AIG were to fail, because it's so bound up with other financial firms, that they determined this was something that had to be done. This was not something that was done out of ideology or out of a, you know, concern for AIG's shareholders. This was, you know, really about concern that something could really, really, really go haywire in the financial system if AIG were allowed to fail.
But where did the turnabout come from? The Treasury Department and the Fed said, we are not going to step in, we're not going to help Lehman Brothers, we're not going to help Merrill Lynch. And within a couple of hours last night, suddenly they were throwing $85 billion at AIG.
You know, the analogy I'd make is this. If you put up a three-story office building, you know, in a strip mall somewhere, and your engineer was incompetent and it starts to fall over, the authorities might just let it fall over because it'll just crumble into the parking lot and everybody's warned and can get out of the way. It won't damage anybody. If you put up an 80-story skyscraper in the middle of Manhattan, and it turns out your engineers and builders were incompetent, and when this building starts to fall, it could knock over the Empire State Building and cause huge amounts of damage and, you know, kill lots of people, the authorities will come running to their rescue. They will mobilize all their resources. And what you had, the difference between Lehman Brothers, which, you know, messed things up pretty badly, but did not mess things up so badly that their failure would, you know, threaten to take down the whole financial system. AIG was so wired, so leveraged, so recklessly into these new markets, had such a poor command of its own risk that its failure would have threatened to bring down so many other people.
Well, to use your building metaphor, though, I mean, in this particular case, it's not that the building would fall and knock over other buildings. The people who are complicit with AIG are actually in the building. I mean, you've got the airline industry. You've got all these leasing arrangements with the airlines. You've got the movie industry. I mean, all these industries are actually in the building.
Yeah, well, the airline leasing, and that's actually a part of AIG that is functioning pretty well. The real issue is AIG, you know, is an insurance company, and so it insures big purchases and, you know, companies and helps finance things. But one of the things it insures is financial products like bonds and these complex CDOs and other what they call structured financial products. They provided insurance on those. And we know that those products have been failing. And, you know, the big issue for any insurance company is if you agree to insure something and a storm hits, all of a sudden you have to make good on all those claims. So AIG was facing something like a hurricane, and because of the complicated nature of these businesses, I think investors and the market as a whole did not have a great amount of transparency or a sense of just what their exposure was, which is why, you know, this thing ended the way a lot of marriages do. You know, it sort of slowly and then all at once.
And I think that we can also tag on to that, Daniel Gross, a to be continued. We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you, sir.
Anytime.
Daniel Gross, senior editor and columnist at Newsweek magazine, to be continued.
Bad marriage, falling building. And he also mentioned hurricane in there. They're not thinking about AIG down in Galveston, Texas. Harvey Rice is the Galveston Bureau reporter for the Houston Chronicle. And his wife, Jackie Cole, is also on the line with us. Harvey and Jackie, you know, you're not thinking about financial bailouts, but I imagine the rebuild from Hurricane Ike is very much on your minds this morning. How are you both doing, Harvey?
I'm doing fine, all things considered.
I've heard of that show. It's on public radio, I think. Harvey, what's going on in your neighborhood?
Our neighborhood is pretty devastated. It's probably one of the, if you drive down our street, which is Sidnor Lane, by the golf course, you can see a lot of destruction, a lot of houses. There are cars picked up and moved and torn away. There's a pickup truck where they removed the body of one of our neighbors who tried to get out through the storm and didn't make it.
Oh, that's terrible.
Facades are ripped away on a lot of houses. Most of the houses are two stories with the built to code so that the bottom, you're not supposed to live in the bottom, but all of them have been framed. The bottom is framed in, and they were all built to have a living area. So, for instance, in ours, we had our utility room was downstairs. There was a washer and dryer inside the house. With both those are now outside the house, and well, it looks like a sledgehammer was taken to them, and they're so beat up.
I mean, you laugh, Jackie, but that really describes the force that Hurricane Ike had when it disrupted all of these living areas, and it created animal orphans that you're dealing with on a daily basis. Tell me about the animal rescue effort that's going on in Galveston, Jackie.
Oh, good morning. I laugh because it's hard to not, if you do anything else, you just become overwhelmed. It's unbelievable, the devastation and destruction. The animals, there's a massive animal rescue relief situation going on. There are a number of rescue organizations in there that I can't remember them all, so if I miss them, I'm sorry to you all, but it's the Houston SPCA. There's some people here from Missouri. There's some people here from from Louisiana. The state has sent down animal rescue trained teams with a veterinary hospital. I'm a veterinarian there on the island, and typically what I'm doing is my clients have contacted me about of animals that they've had to leave in their homes because they were unable to catch them before they left, or feral animals that were colonies they were feeding outside, and I'm going sort of house to house looking for animals of my clients that they've called, and then assisting however I can at the rescue center that's been set up as a temporary shelter. They're picking up animals out on the street that they found, and then also people are bringing animals in there to be cared for while they are out away from the island and unable to care for them because of their living situations.
Well, Harvey, how do we how do you as a journalist perform a kind of public service telling people what the state of their neighborhoods is? Because I imagine, I guess there was a 10-mile line yesterday of people wanting to get in to even just see a look of the most devastated area. Harvey?
During the hurricane, I just went into reporter mode, and I just tried not to think about my house. Obviously, that was the back of my mind, and I frankly thought that once I was able to get to it, and I was not able to get to it at all the first day after the hurricane. It wasn't until late on Sunday, the second day, that the waters receded far enough that I could get to my house. But it was actually better off than I thought, because I was thinking I wouldn't have anything left.
Well, we're grateful for that. You lucked out, Harvey. When we come back, I want to put you back into journalist mode and get an assessment of what this rebuilding is going to take for the entire community. We're going to break away for headlines. Harvey Rice and Jackie Cole, hold on. We'll be right back with you.
And Hurricane Ike, Ohio, still over 1 million people with no electricity. And in Missouri and Mississippi, they're waiting to see if any flooding kicks in as the rivers crest. Still lots to come on Hurricane Ike.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We return now to Galveston, Texas, where the aftermath of Hurricane Ike is very much on the minds of people there. Jackie Cole has been helping with the animal rescue effort in devastated Galveston, and her husband Harvey Rice is the Galveston Bureau reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Jackie, how are residents learning about the state of their property so they can make decisions on what to do in the coming weeks?
Well, it's very difficult because the devastation is widespread, and it's also spotty. Some neighborhoods had water 3 to 4 feet in every house in the neighborhood, and a block away you would have a house with no damage or at least maybe wind damage to the roof or a tree down. So it's very spotty. Most people and the reporters down there are just overwhelmed doing all other kinds of stories than individual house destruction. So most people, there's some people who have stayed on the island, and there's a lot of information coming out on internet and blogs. So that's an interesting way that the news is coming out on an individual basis.
Harvey, what is the stage now of the rebuilding? I gather insurance adjusters are going to start moving through there. The power has to come on for any significant rebuilding to take place. And then what are the residents of Galveston looking at?
Well, at this point, there is no power, there is no water, except to some very limited areas. There is no natural gas. There are no stores open. And they're urging people to get off the island, and they're not allowing people to come back. And right now, the estimates are that power will not be restored for at least a month. There's worries about disease and health problems, and they have been busing people who want to leave the island. And then they're about, out of a population of roughly 60,000, as of yesterday, they were estimating maybe 15 to 20,000 people on the island. They were urging them to get off the island, and there's even been some talk of forcing them to leave the island, and they haven't come to that pass yet.
Well, Jackie, before we go, give us an optimistic story about an animal you've managed to help in these troubled days.
I had a client who I needed to evacuate her animals because she doesn't live on the island currently. She went summer someplace else, and I went to her house, and I was not able to find all of them. So I went back yesterday and waded through all of the mud in her house where the water had come in, and we were able to find one of the cats that had returned to her home and take it out. I saw another one there, so we know there's no dead cats. They're fearing for their own. And another really sweet story is that outside one of the apartment complexes near where I work are three domestic geese. Large domestic geese that have been sort of the pets of the apartment complex for 10 years now.
Well, the geese are standing guard there in Galveston as the...
Absolutely, they're still there. People, they made it.
The people are contemplating the tough decisions ahead. Jackie Cole, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Harvey Rice also, a Galveston Bureau reporter for the Houston Chronicle, and Jackie Cole has been helping with the animal rescue effort there in Galveston. Adora?
And the other big story this week, John, is the economy and the troubles there. And the presidential candidates have been attacking each other's plans relentlessly. Each have released new ads trying to outdo the other. For more, we're going to Jonathan Martin from Politico.com, who's been following the campaigns, and he joins us now. Good morning, Jonathan.
Good morning.
So McCain's got some new ads. What's his message in responding to what's happening in the economy?
It's interesting. This is a fascinating window onto John McCain. On the one hand, he's a traditional pro-business, less taxes, low regulation Republican, but he also has some Teddy Roosevelt impulses, the sort of populist, trust-busting outrage. And we've seen more of that Roosevelt side on display here. He recognizes that people are deeply concerned about the financial crisis. They may not know entirely why they're concerned, but he does recognize recognize that people are affected by this turmoil. And so he has taken to the stump and also included in ads some really populist language, guys, talking about the greed of these Wall Street executives that spurred this crisis, and that how he plans to crack down on these practices and will institute a new framework of regulations to deal with this issue and make sure that it doesn't happen again. But there is a bit of a conflict there because he is traditionally more a deregulator.
Interesting that you said he may not know why the economy is struggling as it is, because, of course, that's the hole that Barack Obama jumped through based on statements McCain made on Monday suggesting that the fundamentals of our economy are strong.
Right. Right, exactly. You know, his first event Monday, he said something that he's, you know, mentioned dozens of times, guys, on the campaign trail during the course of this year. It's an optimistic statement meant to reassure Americans that the fundamentals of the economy are still strong. The problem with that, he had just released an ad saying the economy is in crisis and the market was plunging and these brokerage houses are going bust. So it was sort of a ill-chosen turn of phrase. He quickly changed his words later in the day when his staff realized that he had been opened up for attack. But you know, that's not the only thing McCain has said. He also in the past has said that economics is not something that he understands very, very well. And Democrats have hammered him for that, too. But, guys, the fact is on this, I don't think Obama or McCain really have a full appreciation for why this happened and the extent of what a law means. And they are scrambling right now to address these issues in a campaign that less than a week ago was being fought on, you know, process and Sarah Palin. And it's now rejiggered and focused on real issues.
Well, I'm grateful that it's back to the issues. Speaking of scrambling, though, does McCain have a bailout problem because of his history in the savings and loan crisis?
You know, I'm not sure how many voters recall that. I mean, obviously, Democrats could use that against him, but I'm not sure how resonant that is to this day, John.
That's probably a good news for McCain, then.
Yeah, I mean, I would think so. But, you know, McCain's bigger challenge, John, on this is simply voters recognize the country is headed in the wrong direction. 80-20, that's what they say in the polls. What this crisis reminds them of, things are not right somehow in this country. They may not know exactly what happened on Wall Street. They just recognize here's yet more evidence for a country unsettled. And, you know, that therefore brings an impulse to change. Why would they have the same party for a third term when they believe the country's headed in the wrong direction? So for me, the meta challenge here for McCain is it just reminds voters of problems here.
Jonathan Martin, 5 weeks and counting, right?
We're counting it down. I think we're at 48 days.
48 days. Thank
Who's
you.
Who's counting?
48 days. Thank you, sir. Jonathan Martin.
Thanks, guys.
It's a reporter for Politico.com.
We're talking about bailouts. How much should the government be willing to bail out financial companies in need? And how does this week's financial news affect your confidence? Scramble like the candidates to respond to the financial crisis at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, probing topical issues such as mothers who meet at a bar for drinks and bring their babies. Is it fair to the other patrons? Is it fair for bars to prohibit them? Conversations found at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. We have some headlines for you right now from Femi. Okay, Femi.
Thanks, Adore. It is 28 minutes to the top of the hour, which means the markets have been open for 2 minutes. And, John, we're looking at, what, a drop of 200 so far?
207-point drop on the Dow Jones Industrial Average at this point. S&P down 22 points.
Great. Thank you. Or not so great, unfortunately. New numbers also in from the Commerce Department. They say that construction fell 6.2% last month to its lowest level in 17 years. And that's a much bigger drop than expected. And the trade deficit is up 4.3% in the last quarter to more than $183 billion. 16 people are dead this morning after a coordinated attack on the U.S. embassy in Yemen's capital city. An Islamic jihadi group staged the attack and some were dressed as policemen. They detonated at least two car bombs and engaged guards in a gun battle. Four civilians were killed. The group is threatening more strikes if some of their members aren't released from jail. It should be a day of rejoicing for people who want their very own offshore oil rig in U.S. waters, but Republicans don't think so. They're objecting to provisions in an energy bill that passed the House last night. Democrats roll back a decades-long ban on offshore drilling as long as the platforms are 50 miles from the coast. Republicans say that's too far, and the bill heads to the Senate next, but the president says that he will veto it. Let's look at some of the main stories making news today.
Thank you, Femi. The bailout of AIG and the financial turmoil of the last week that we're seeing on Wall Street reflected on the markets right now. The Dow Jones Industrial Average down 205 points, the S&P down 25 points. It's almost 2%. As people taking another look at the regulatory scheme in the financial markets, some say the Securities and Exchange Commission has much to answer for when it comes to the current turmoil. Robert Heim was a former assistant regional director of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission in New York from 1993 to 1999. Robert Heim, good morning.
Good morning, John.
Christopher Cox, who is head of the SEC now, famously told Congress a few months back that he wasn't particularly interested in more regulations to help prevent problems like with Bear Stearns and in the subprime mortgage crisis. What was your reaction to that?
Well, John, I think essentially the idea of no more regulation and a hands-off approach by the regulators is going to be over on Wall Street. The latest government bailouts of financial institutions have put taxpayer money at risk, and there's really been a sea change now. Once the government starts to loan money to failing firms and putting taxpayers at risk, they're going to want more oversight of these financial institutions. And the idea of less regulation was pretty popular over the last 8 years. It was promoted by industry, who said it would be anti-competitive to put more government regulation on them. They argued for self-regulation, but it has not turned out the way that they anticipated.
Why didn't Sarbanes-Oxley have any sort of impact here after the Enron crisis?
Well, that's an interesting question. And essentially, Sarbanes-Oxley was really directed at publicly traded companies in terms of improving their disclosures and management oversight. And what we really have here in this situation is firms that have had very toxic assets on their balance sheets. These investment banks had very complicated financial products, a lot of which were tied to housing and mortgage products.
Yeah, I think that's well understood. What they weren't always toxic, though, Robert. And explain to me how companies can get around regulations of stocks by creating new instruments, just basically new paper. We'll call it a widget-orama, and it's worth this much, and I'll give you this, and you give me this money, and all of a sudden you're in a completely unregulated zone.
Oh, that's right, John. That's one of the key problems of what led to this crisis are these very complicated structured finance products, which were created over the last 5 or 6 years by investment banks. And really, there's not a very good methodology in terms of valuing them. We had rating agencies that were supposed to review these products and give them appropriate ratings based on their risk level. But many of the rating agencies issued investment-grade ratings on these products, leading to their widespread adoption by many investors and many investment banks. And the basic problem here is that there's not enough transparency in investment banks. Many of these products don't trade on exchanges. They're done in private transactions. And regulators really don't know the inner workings of what's going on at investment banks. And part of that problem stems from the fact that our regulatory structure really is a product of the 1930s. It was put into place after the Great Depression. There's a separation between the SEC, the Federal Reserve, the commodities regulators. So a lot of times the regulators are just looking at a very narrow part of the business, when in reality there's much riskier assets on the business that stretch across all business lines.
Robert, what makes this a little interesting is the exact same people who made those decisions urging for less oversight are now the exact ones who are trying to help the Fed and the Treasury Department help them dig themselves out. How does that portray, and how should I have any confidence in that as an American consumer?
Well, that's exactly the most ironic part of the companies approaching the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department for loans. Some of the leaders of these companies for the last 8 or 9 years were the biggest proponents of the free market and arguing against more regulation. Now that their firms have gotten into financial trouble, they've lined up for government bailouts. And it really is a bit of hypocrisy on the part of the leaders of these firms. The government drew a line in the sand, the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department, when they allowed Lehman Brothers to fail. They didn't want to encourage this kind of expectation that the government would bail out more financial firms.
But they certainly talked about the creation of all these new instruments as this innovative kind of miracle of the marketplace. And I love how you describe it. Basically, banks were permitted to create paper. They call up Moody's and say, here, you rate this paper. And all of a sudden, it trades like a stock, and all the fate of banks and portfolios all over the world are in the balance.
That's absolutely right. This is really a global crisis. Mortgages that were made out in the Midwest were spun out into these financial products, and much of it was located here in the U.S., but many of those products were also sold overseas.
Well, it's a very disheartening legacy, but thank you so much for helping to explain it to us.
Thanks a lot, John.
Robert Heim, formerly an assistant regional director of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission in New York City, talking to us about just how unregulated this new world is.
And we've heard from many people this morning about whether or not the government should be bailing out companies like that, and perhaps even whether bailing out is the right word. Kelly calls, sent us an email and says, AIG's bailout, quote, is a loan for $85 billion for 80% of the company, not even an equity purchase. Some call that a bailout. I call it a fire sale. The shareholders will sue with some justification that the price was too low. I say the government did a great job of leveraging their balance sheet and picking up an incredible asset on the cheap. But please don't characterize this as a bailout. And here's another thought.
Good morning. I work at a bank at Secaucus, New Jersey. My name is Jessica. In the bank, all we see is streams of senior citizens worried about their life savings. Are they FDIC insured? We as taxpayers, how much back are we going to get from that $85 million invested in AIG? When they start making a profit, when the interest comes in from the loan, how much of that are they going to give to taxpayers?
Some of those seniors with memories of the Depression, I'm sure.
Lots of questions. We want to hear your thoughts. 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. And John, we have some more on that developing story happening out of Yemen. We're going to go straight to the BBC correspondent, Christian Fraser, who's actually based in Cairo, to find out more, Christian, about what is being reported, what you know about what happened at the U.S. Embassy in Yemen today.
Well, a lot of the details that we're getting from our people on the ground there suggest that this was quite a well-coordinated attack. The bomb, the car bomb that went off about 8:30 in the morning, just after the U.S. embassy was opening, was targeted at the main entrance to the compound. And it appears that shortly after that bomb, a second car arrived. This was full of militants dressed in police gear. They opened fire on the security staff at the embassy. They strafed the building with small arms fire and rockets. And in total, 16 people were killed, 6 guards, 6 attackers, and other people who were in the near vicinity. But the U.S. embassy have told us that none of their staff were hurt this morning, and that might be because they've drawn down a lot of their staff. Non-essential staff were sent home to the United States shortly after an attack in March. This was a mortar attack. 3 mortars fired at the compound. They all missed and hit a school nearby. But together with this attack, clearly there are concerns about the safety of people that are working there.
This is, as you said, clearly not the first time the U.S. embassy has been attacked in Yemen. Describe what's happening there with militancy.
Well, if you cast your mind back to the year 2000, you'll remember the attack on the USS Cole, and that was really the time when Yemen featured, I think, on the U.S. watch list. But if you go further back than that to the 1980s, there were tens of thousands of Arab fighters that were coming back from the war against the Soviets in Afghanistan. And whereas Saudi Arabia were trying to find a way to take them in, Yemen actively welcomed them into the country. So this has always been a country that has been seen as somewhat of a haven for militants. And certainly in recent times, there has been good reason for concern. This is a fast-growing population, a lot of young people, but it's very much like Afghanistan. It's a mountainous terrain, very tribal, and a lot of weapons in the area. So although the government of Yemen and the President Ali Abdullah Saleh has been working with the US on the war on terror, he finds himself walking a very fine line, trying to keep security in his country, but also trying to play the US game. And it's not something he can do easily, because it's not easy to track these militants.
So a group called the Islamic Jihad has claimed responsibility for the attack this morning on the U.S. embassy. What do you know about this group?
Well, it's a group different to the Palestinian Islamic Jihad of the same name, but it has been and has been involved in attacks before in Yemen. And it says that it's going to carry on these attacks not only on U.S. targets, but also British and Saudi Arabian and United Arab Emirate targets in the region as well, unless its members are released from jail. So this is, of course, going to be of concern to all the Western embassies and the UN that are working in the region. Security has been very tight since the attack in March. And as I say, there were some staff returning because there had been a period of relative calm. But obviously, this will mean that things will have to be stepped up again. And I'm sure there will be a security review in all the Western embassies over the next few days.
Christian Fraser, thank you for joining us. Christian Fraser is a BBC correspondent, and he was coming to us from Cairo.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. We want to bring you up to date on all the latest headlines. Femi Okeh has joined us with those. Femi.
Thank you very much. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The federal government has agreed to provide an $85 billion emergency loan to rescue American International Group. The Federal Reserve says it determined that a disorderly failure of the huge insurer could hurt the already delicate financial markets and the economy. Defense Secretary Robert Gates is in Afghanistan to meet with officials and offer his personal regret for U.S. airstrikes that have mistakenly killed civilians. He blamed the use of airstrikes on a lack of U.S. ground troops in the country, and he pledged more accurate targeting in the future. Homeland Security Secretary, Michael Chertoff will be back in Texas today to take a look at post-Ike recovery efforts in Houston and Galveston. And Houston's Mayor Bill White has said he's unhappy with FEMA. He says they're not delivering supplies fast enough. Quick look at your main stories for this morning.
Thank you, Femi. So, at the top of the hour, we suggested, what would it be like to have fish oil in orange juice? What would that taste like? Well, it turns out it tastes just like orange juice, because the technology for putting so-called nutraceuticals, food with medicinal vitamin additives, the technology for doing that has changed radically and has allowed food processor to do all kinds of things, make all kinds of combinations that we've never heard about in the past. To explain this trend and how it's actually accomplished is Julia Moskins of the New York Times. Julia, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Nutraceuticals are an interesting example of food processing, right? Because it's interesting science how you get fish oil into orange juice. But it's also a trend that's been around for quite some time.
Absolutely. Fortified foods have been a huge public health success and were in the 20th century. And so we have to be careful not to be too automatically dismissive of these new efforts by many of the major food companies to put added nutrients in their food. Those added nutrients are called nutraceuticals, and the foods that contain them are often called functional foods. the way that the companies now are able to get the food, the nutraceutical ingredients in, is imperceptible in a way that didn't used to be possible.
Now, why is that the case? I mean, why don't I taste fish in orange juice?
That is because of amazing technology called microencapsulation, for the most part, in which tiny beads of oil can be encapsulated in fat or protein or gelatin so small that they are not perceptible by the human tongue. And that's a big issue for food processors. Nobody wants their food to taste different. Nobody wants to, as one technologist said to me, burp up fish oil after drinking the orange juice.
What if you're a vegetarian, though? Does that still make the orange juice? It's not a vegetarian orange juice anymore.
No, it's not. All of it has to be carefully labeled and clearly labeled. That is how the FDA does regulate all foods. They don't regulate these foods differently, but you would see on a container of Tropicana Healthy Heart orange juice that it says quite prominently contains sardines, anchovies, and tilapia. But now, you do have to be looking.
Now, we should add that a lot of the data on whether these things are actually good for you, whether the amounts that you would consume in orange juice actually contribute to health, the jury is really pretty much out on a lot of this data.
Yes, it's completely out. And this is the big difference between vitamin D fortification, say, and Dan and yogurt with probiotics. The public health research simply hasn't been done. And there was a landmark court decision in 1999, Pearson versus Shalala, that allowed food packagers and makers of dietary supplements to label their packages with health claims that had not been proven in a new way. And we're seeing the results of that court decision showing up on the shelves now.
But let's look on the positive side. I mean, there are great successes of food additives in terms of improving public health. I mentioned iodine in salt. What was that intended to correct, and how well did it do?
That did a great job of eliminating a terrible disease called goiter, in which people's glands became very swollen in their necks. And many of these things were huge problems. And there is a great deal of proof in the value of certain of these products, especially omega-3 fatty acids, even in this new form. But a lot of things like antioxidants is a term that gets tossed around all the time. Now, a tomato has plenty of antioxidants, and no one has a doubt that that is a healthy product. But when you have pulped a tomato, treated it to extract the lycopene, and then microencapsulated that lycopene, and then drink it in, a strawberry smoothie, no one is quite sure how that might affect you nutritionally.
That's kind of a next question, which is, at some point, are you sort of creating food Frankensteins? I mean, if you want the nutrition from a tomato, eat a tomato.
That is really what it comes down to, you know, and without, obviously, as a food journalist, no one tends to be more cynical about the efforts of food companies to try to sell you things that are more nutritional than food. However, many of these things are hitting the shelves, so we just thought it was time to clear up some of these claims.
Well, but it's also the case that the entire business model of the food industry is to create these value-added propositions by changing the food in some way, either changing the shape or the texture or the flavor. And the food additives, a sort of health component, is just another part of the same business model. It's not going to go away.
Absolutely. It is all about value-added. And many of them do have added value. It's simply that we're really not sure what they are. Kraft is about to come out with a cheese that includes something that was developed by a green pesticides company, which is actually a form of cheese that can kill intestinal parasites.
Oh, great.
Okay.
Oh, that's good.
But
what do the farmers think about that?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the farmers are working hard and food prices are up, and they're in favor of anything that sells more food generally. I mean, part of the problem right now is that there was a much more of a market for premium priced products with cereals with added honey, roasted almonds, that kind of thing. And with the rise in transport costs and raw materials costs, manufacturers are looking for a much more inexpensive model for adding value to food.
Well, there's eating healthy, and then there's eating healthy food additives, and they aren't really the same thing. Julia Moskin, thanks so much for joining us. Julia Moskin is New York Times dining section reporter.
And all morning, John, we've been covering what's happening with the markets. Wall Street opened less than a half an hour ago, and immediately, despite the $85 billion the U.S. has set out for insurance giant AIG, the Dow dropped over 200 points. It's now rebounded a bit, but we're going to check in with Daniel Gross, who's a senior editor and a columnist at Newsweek magazine. Welcome back, Daniel. So, are you surprised, perhaps, that there was an immediate drop
No, not really. You have to remember that AIG is one of the 30 stocks that is in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. So, you know, it falling by a chunk, which it has done and was bound to do, was going to bring the Dow down by a pretty dramatic amount. Looking at the screens right now, stocks are off about, you know, broadly speaking, a percentage and a half. AIG is down 42% today alone. It went from about 4 to about 2. So, you know, all in all, I think this opening is not catastrophic. And I would be very slow to call a bottom or to say that the worst is over. But, you know, there just aren't that many big companies left to fail now.
Right. I mean, I guess the question is there a sign of a big drop in confidence that would carry us much lower? Or are we seeing really just a lot of bottom feeding right now and that people are looking for bargains and the markets maybe have, you know, are out of the woods for the time being?
We spoke before about how the problem, you know, it's not small companies failing, it's gigantic ones failing. And what's happened in the last 2 weeks is Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the two largest financial institutions in this country failed, taken over by the taxpayer. AIG, the largest insurance company in the country, failed, taken over by the government. Lehman Brothers, the fourth largest investment bank, bankrupt. Merrill Lynch, first or second, depending on how you want to define it, sold to a sound bank. So there really aren't that many large institutions left to fail outside of the regulated areas. In other words, banks are
Dan, stop talking. The stock market is plunging as you're speaking right now.
Even more? Yeah, it's
down another 20 more points. Yeah, I think so. I think you're definitely at fault here. Well, what should we look for tomorrow, quickly?
I guess more. I wouldn't say more of the same. I think the thing to look out for now is, A, back to the economy. People will be focusing on whether we're growing, whether we're contracting, and the way in which Lehman Brothers, this process of failure continues to take place. Will people be buying up the assets of Lehman Brothers? How is Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, how are they going to function? How are these new arrangements going to work between the government and these private companies, or formerly private companies?
And that's not a short process by itself, I might add, Dan, which is why we're probably going to be talking to you again sometime real soon. Daniel Gross, thank you.
Anytime.
Daniel Gross, senior editor and columnist at Newsweek magazine.
He makes a great point. All this stuff is for sale, and now the question is how it's going to get bought up. There's lots of ways to catch up with us at The Takeaway. You can find us on Twitter, Friend Feed, and Facebook.
We're talking about the damage by Hurricane Ike, and we're also finding out how many companies are trying to make your food healthier.
Who should you vote for? Go to Facebook and The Takeaway will help you add qualities you want in a president. We'll tell you who to vote for. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway